So what I will be talking about is will be a kind of review of several works with different people. So with Tristan Rivière, Chandu, Bob Gerard, Yonit Danaïla, and I hope to have time to talk about our latest result, which is just going to appear next week in Physical Review Letters. And anyway, everything that I'm going to talk about today is included in a compte rendu note, which is going to appear in the compte rendu for the French Academy of Science and Physics. So everything that I'm going to talk about was motivated by very recent experiments. When I say very recent, it started in 1999 and it's going on in the group of Jean Dalibard, who's in the Laboratoire Kessler-Brossel at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. So in my talk, I will present the physical background, then I will kind of introduce a mathematical energy that we have worked on, and then I will use the kind of framework that Giovanni Alberti described in the sense that I will derive a simplified energy, and from that simplified energy try to understand the pattern that are appearing. So first of all, the physical background. For those of you who haven't heard about it, so I just recall quickly what is the Bose-Einstein condensate. Actually, this dates back to 1925 to the prediction of Bose and Einstein that for a gas of non-interacting particles, then there is a critical temperature under which there's a macroscopic fraction of the gas which is condensed. And condensed means in the state of lowest energy of zero momentum. But of course, at that time, there was no experimental device that allowed people to observe this experimentally. So it was just theoretical. And one of the reasons was that at the temperatures required by the experiments, all materials were in the solid state. So people had to figure out how to cool down materials and to keep them in a state that was close to a gas. So when superfluid helium was discovered in 1937, there was a link which was made with Einstein's theory, but there are a lot of differences between superfluid helium and Bose-Einstein condensate. And it's only in 1995, so 70 years after the theory was made, that people in the US, in the GEO group, and then in MIT, managed to condense alkali gases to obtain Bose-Einstein condensation. And they obtained the Nobel Prize in 2001 for it. So it was Cornell and Wieman in Gila and Ketterle at the MIT. So today there are more than 30 groups in the world who have experimental devices with Bose-Einstein condensate, and a lot of these properties of these systems are being studied both experimentally and theoretically. And one of the focus is on vortices, or at least on experimental evidence that a condensate is superfluid. And for that purpose, there are two different kinds of experiments. Either once you have your condensate, the first experiment that was made in 95 at MIT was to stir a laser along the condensate, and people realize that there's a critical velocity under which no energy is released by this motion. And this is what I'm going to talk about at the very end of the talk. But the main part of my talk will be devoted to the other experiment, which is called the rotated bucket experiment, which was realized in Paris in 1999. And so you imagine that your condensate has a cigar shape. It's this red region, that you're rotating it along the Z direction, and a consequence of superfluidity is that there are permanent currents when you rotate your condensate. So at the ENS, they obtain up to 20 or 30 vortices, and the experiment was reproduced at MIT more recently, and now they have up to 130 vortices. So the experimental setup is the following, is that first the atomic gases are brought to extremely low density. And maybe I should say what is written here. And they are cooled rapidly. And because of the trapping and the way the system is cooled down, the distribution of atoms has a special shape. It has a cigar shape. And this is something that is going to stay in the mathematics, so maybe I should point on this. And so if I come back to the ENS experiment, a rotating perturbation is created by stirring a laser, and the trapping potential is rotating, like you when you use a spoon in a coffee cup and you start rotating. And what they observe is that when the velocity is not too big, then there's no modification on the condensate. And when you reach a threshold, then you have a density dip which appears. And at that time in 99, or at least when it appeared in 2000, they conjectured that the vortex line was not straight but bending. But now their observation, both numerical and experimental, that the vortex line is indeed bending. And you have this kind of thing. No. Okay. So the condensate is this thing. You're rotating it along the z-axis, and you observe a vortex which has this shape here. This picture is numerical. I'll show you the experimental, or I can show you the experimental picture right now. The thing is that when they did the first experiment in 2000, they couldn't get this kind of thing. They could only do optical observation through sections. So that's why it was only a conjecture that the vortex line was bending, because they could only measure optical density. And it's only last year that they managed to get, so the slide is not so good, so that's why. So it's 2002, right, that they managed to get both the longitudinal imaging and the transverse imaging. And so if I remove this red thing, then you can see I don't know whether you can see roughly the vortex here. I won't insist on the next one because these are more complex setting, but if I put this, the vortex is there. Then there's the question of how they do the imaging, and the condensate is slightly different shape from the way I'm going to present, but I'll come back to this later. Okay, so the aim is to end, the mathematical aim was trying to understand why the vortex is bending like that. Can we get from an energy a simplified model and obtain something that could justify this shape. Okay. So the model goes through the Gross-Pitayevsky energy. So you have to take into account the fact that the condensate is trapped. So the trapping, which gives the special shape, is taken into account here in this non-homogeneous trapping potential. And then you have a rotating term, which is here. And in the setting of the experiment, so it turns out that you can non-dimensionalize the energy and the equation in such a way that you introduce a small parameter, epsilon, which is small in the sense that it's of the order of 10 to the minus 2 of 10 to the minus 3, and it's going to provide you with an energy that has common properties with energies that people had studied up to now. So maybe I will write it in the blackboard just to keep it. So I don't want to insist on all the rescaling and so on. So from that, doing some rescaling, it's reasonable to study an energy E epsilon of U, which is going to be, okay, let me, 1/2 of gradient U squared plus 1 over epsilon squared rho of x, rho TF of x, yz minus U squared. So you see here that I have something which is going to be space dependent, minus omega cross r times iu grad u. So what I should say is that rho tf is going to be rho naught minus x squared plus alpha squared y squared plus beta squared z squared. And I define the domain D to be the place where this function rho tf is positive. So if I choose, like in the experiment alpha, to be of order 1, beta to be 1 over 7 or 1 over 15, then eventually my domain D is in effect something which is an ellipsoid, which is going to be something like that. Okay, this is the Z direction. So this is the domain D, and for the mathematics, I will tell Q, which is with zero value. So compared to what has been described up to now, the difference is that here you have something which is coming from the trapping potential due to the fact that for the condensate, you really need to trap the atoms. And the particularity is that this function is vanishing on the boundary of the domain, which is giving some trouble in some of the analysis. All right, so now what I want to do, of course, is to decouple the energy in order to understand the shape of the minimizers and to understand whether when I minimize this energy, there are vortices and what is their shape. So the first thing to understand is when epsilon is small, what is going on with the profile of the solution? Because up to now, in the talks you have seen, the modulus of U was going to 1 and the vortices were tubes more or less of size epsilon and you had a line of singularity. But here the modulus, because of this trapping potential, the modulus is not going to 1. It's going, in effect, to the function rho tf. So the first thing to do is to minimize the energy in a space where you don't have any zeros. And you find that the modulus of the function is tending to rho tf, except on the boundary layer, which is of size epsilon to the 2/3. And on this boundary layer, because the function square root of rho tf is not in H1, you have a matching of 0 to a function which is in H1. And the specific, so for the modulus of the solution, it's easier to find the limit. For the phase, there's something particular happening. That is, for the experiment, in order to start the rotation, they cannot take alpha to be exactly 1. It's like when you blow on something, you have to have two different radius. So as soon as alpha is slightly different from 1, you're going to have a phase which is globally defined at zero order. So, and the way you can see it is that if you write the Euler-Lagrange equation corresponding to the minimization of the energy, which is over there, you look at the equation for the phase, and you can do an analogy with fluid dynamics. That is, you can define the equivalent of a stream function. That is, here you have a divergence-free equation, so you can write the inside term here to be a curl, and the curl of a function xi, which is an equivalent of a stream function. And for this function xi, you can derive an equation. So the way you do it is just you divide by f squared on each side, then you take the curl again, and you find that you have a very simple equation for xi, because in this equation passes to the limit in the sense that 1 over f squared is tending to 1 over rho tf, and this equation is in the limit. In the case where rho tf is, the special trapping potential that I wrote over there has an exact solution that you can compute. And this is very important in all the analysis that is going to follow, and this function is more or less rho squared times some constant along the z direction. And if you go back, you plug this back into this equation, you find that in some sense, the phase S epsilon is tending to a phase which is globally defined, which is xy times some constant, and this constant is different from zero as soon as your cross-section, the cross-section of the ellipsoid, is not a disk. So maybe this is something that I should add here on the blackboard, just in order to remember, is that what I'm going to have is that U epsilon square is going to tend to rho tf in every compact subset, and I define eta epsilon, which is going to be F epsilon EIS epsilon, which is the minimizer I define here, and with the constraint that I don't have vortices, so I have F epsilon square is tending to rho tf, and S epsilon is like, alpha squared minus 1 over alpha squared plus 1 times xy. So once I have the profile of the solution, now what I need to understand is what is the contribution of vortices. And there's an idea which goes back to Petru Mironescu, which consists in decoupling the energy in terms of the profile contribution and the vortex contribution. So you start from a minimizer, you're going to divide it by the profile, and then you want to understand what's the rest of it. And you can decouple the energy into three terms, and it's an exact decoupling. So what happens to this function V epsilon, which is the quotient of U divided by eta, what you expect is that in modulus it's going to be 1 everywhere except close to the vortices. And the vortices will be tubes of size epsilon around which you have a degree. I mean, in the classical way that it was introduced by Betruel Brésicelin in 2D and Rivière and Lin and Rivière, and then used by all the people that have been quoted in this conference. Okay, so what you do, what you obtain when you do this decoupling, you find that the energy of the solution is the energy of eta epsilon, which is the energy of the profile, which in that case is going to be of size log epsilon squared. So the leading order term is of size log epsilon to the square. And then you have two terms. One term here is the energy of vortices. So you find that it's very close to the usual Ginzburg-Landau energy, except that you have a weight here in front of the gradient term and in front of the nonlinear term. And the third term is due to rotation. So it's, you have some weight as well, and then you have a phase contribution due to the global phase, the rotation, and then the usual Jacobian term. So if you do the analysis, what you find, so, is the energy of the envelope will be of order log epsilon to the square. It's the leading order term, but you want to subtract it and understand when or for which value of omega the sum of the next two are going to give a contribution which is going to lower the energy. And so what you find is, compared with the other talks, is that the energy of vortices here is going to be pi log epsilon, of course, times, usually you expect to have the length. But because you have a weight here, your length is going to be weighted by the weight. And recall that the weight is going to zero on the boundary. And then the terms due to rotation is going to give a contribution which has the opposite sign, and also which has which is oriented. So it's not, maybe I should explain the reason for that very quickly. So the first term is going to give the contribution of the vortex, which is more or less the length times this weight. But the second term, because you have this special identity that I wrote before, you remember when I said before, I said there is a global phase that is defined, and this global phase, you can see it from a stream function, and because you have a divergence-free equation. And the stream function psi has a limit that we can identify. So in order to compute this value of this third integral term, what we do is we do an integration by part on the psi, and it turns out that doing this integration by parts, the curl of the gradient of the phase here is giving a delta function along the line, but because the function psi epsilon is oriented along the z-axis, what you end up is you have this scalar product which gives you a dz here. So it's not a dl, it's really an oriented integral that is going to give a contribution in the shape of vortices. So the final estimate is that when you have when you have a vortex line gamma, maybe I should keep this in the board for the rest. You find that at leading order, you have that the energy of your solution minus the energy of the profile is going to behave like the length of the weighted length of the vortex minus the second term that we're going to see as an area term, as a matter of fact. So let me define for the rest of the talk the energy of a line gamma, which is going to be pi log epsilon times the length minus omega pi divided by 1 plus, maybe there's a 2, no, times the integral of rho tf square dv. And if there are several vortices, then of course each of them is going to give a contribution of that type, and then you have an interaction term that comes from with a Bessel function, so you can identify it with the log of the distance between vortices. So I'd say that at that stage here, I've reached the first aim, which was to simplify the energy of the original energy that I was starting with in order to reach a simplified problem which now only depends on the singularity line. And of course, the next aim is to understand the shape of the, according to the value of omega and the shape of rho, to understand the shape of the minimizer of this new energy and to know whether they are going to provide some kind of bending line, or do they provide a straight line. So at that stage, I should say that, so everything that I have presented up to now was included in the work with Tristan Rivière, and that was for a finite number of line of vortices, and we published it in a physics paper, and everything was made rigorous by Bob Gerard. What am I showing? So more precisely, he proved the following theorem: is that if I assume that the rotation, so you see here that the rotation is going to be of order log epsilon in order so that the two terms are the same size. So if you have that omega divided by 1 plus alpha square log epsilon is going to some limit, and you have some bound of order log epsilon square, which is the natural bound for the whole energy, and you have a log epsilon bound on the reduced energy, which is the energy of vortices, then 1 over log epsilon times the energy of a minimizer minus the energy of the profile is gamma converging to something that I call AE of J. That is, I don't want to introduce at this stage all the machinery that Bob has introduced, but in some sense, let's say, you have some kind of gamma convergence to a generalized energy of this shape for one-dimensional current, and so everything relies on gamma limit, and one delicate part in the proof is really due to the degeneracy of rho near the boundary, and it requires, of course, the topological framework for the study of current that Peter has a little talked about the other day. All right, so now what I would like to describe is a more precise study of this single vortex line energy. So we really now want to understand what is the shape of the line gamma minimizing this energy. So from now on, what I will do is that, in fact, instead of considering this energy, I will divide it by log epsilon and pi log epsilon, and so I call omega bar this rescaled omega. And so what we want to do is find the minimizing curve gamma, and in particular understand for which value of omega you have curves such that E of gamma is negative, and to know whether the line gamma is straight along the axis of rotation or is it indeed bending as in the experiment. So the first statement is that if you have a minimizer, then you can prove that the curve is planar and it's in the plane which is closest to the axis of rotation. So if you have that alpha is bigger than 1, it's going to be in the yz plane. And once you have planar curve, then you have an easier setting for the study of this, So you can define, instead of looking at the energy E gamma as I wrote it here, then you can consider that this term will be an area term instead of this oriented integral that I had. So I'm going to define a BV function which is going from my domain D into 0, 1. And so I can identify the length term to be rho gradient of psi. And the other term is exactly what is over there. It's just that we have used a Stokes theorem in between. And sometimes I will call it H to be the first term, which is the weighted length term, and L because this term is usually called by physicists the angular momentum. So it turns out that for any value of omega, either you have the minimizer is either vortex free, or it has to be straight along the axis of rotation, or it has to stay at a finite distance of the axis. Okay, I missed a slide at that stage. Oh no, here it is. So now we want to go a little further into the analysis and understand what is going on. So maybe I want to show this first. So what we can prove is that if beta is bigger than 1, so maybe I should remind you what beta is. In the definition of rho TF up there, sorry? No, it can be any value. Actually, if everything, if you have that alpha is 1, the curve is planar, but it can be in any plane. If it's different from 1, it's planar and you have the specific plane. But I go on with any value of alpha. What I'm going to describe for the moment doesn't depend on alpha. But now what I'm saying is that the value of beta, which is the elongation of the cigar in the z direction, is going to change a lot the shape of vortices. So now if I look at proposition 3, if beta is bigger than 1, this is in the case where you have pancake shape, so you have something which is like a pancake, then you can prove that the energy of the curve is always either bigger than 0 or the energy, what I call gamma S, is the straight vortex along the axis of rotation. So as soon as you have a pancake, you do have straight vortices. But on the other case, if beta is less than 1, so what we can prove is that if beta is less than 1 over square root 3, and if you have some upper bounds on omega, then the straight vortex is unstable. So it means that the minimizer has to be, maybe I should show you this remark here, has to be a U vortex for some region, in the sense that you can compute exactly the critical value of omega for which a straight vortex starts to get negative energy. It's 5/4. And you find out that if omega and rho naught are in this region, which is something that you can reach if beta is sufficiently small, you can find values of omega which is less than 5/4, where you see that the straight vortex is unstable, which means that there is a minimizer and it's either straight nor it has to be some kind of vortex. So this is what is usually called now a U vortex. And one way to understand it better is that if you look at the energy here, maybe you notice that here you have two terms. One is rho, and then you have the minus omega bar rho square. So in order for the energy to be negative, you need that this quantity here is at least negative somewhere, because if it's positive everywhere, then the whole energy is going to be positive. And so as soon as you, that's why the critical value of omega now has to be bigger than 1, because if omega is less than 1, then you can prove that the energy is always positive. So now for fixed omega such that omega bar rho naught is bigger than 1, I can define the inner region where this quantity is negative. So it's going to be an inner ellipsoid into my domain D. And in fact, in this inner region, the minimizer is straight. If you restrict to this region, the minimizer has to be straight. And in the outer region where this quantity is positive, then it's going to use the shortest path. So in some sense, this is why, The shape of the minimizer is going to be something like that, depending on omega. When you increase omega, you realize that, so this is a 3D numerical simulation by Yonit Ben Ayla from Paris 6. When you increase the value of omega, oh, I haven't wrote it here, the different values, sorry. So here, as omega here is increasing, so you realize that the as omega is increasing, this inner region that I've mentioned is going to grow, and it's growing like this, and that's why the place where the vortex is straight is getting bigger and bigger, and in the rest, then it uses the shortest path to go to the boundary. So this is some kind of justification also of the shape. And actually, we could prove... why not C2? Yeah, no, it's the curve is regular. It's just that because it's getting very close to the axis that you have the impression that it's turning. Also, maybe the view here is not exactly, but it's if you zoom on it, then it always has this kind of shape actually. So when you see that the part here is getting bigger and bigger, actually we could prove something which is slightly related in the sense that when omega 1 is less than omega 2, then the domain here included by the vortex and the boundary are included into one another. And also we could prove that for almost every omega, then there is a unique minimizer of E gamma. So this minimizer is the U. But now, of course, I'm coming back to my physics. My physics transparency. It was almost at the same time, because it was in June 2002, when they managed to do this longitudinal imaging. So I must say that here we always draw the z direction along the z direction. But, I mean, the way they do the imaging is that they have the z-direction that way, and because for the imaging they have to let the condensate grow into some direction, you have the impression that the cigar is a pancake, but actually in the original experiment it is a cigar. So, okay, given this, what they notice in this, that's PRL, maybe I should have written down, what they notice is that, okay, you have U vortices, and they notice that this U is getting, depending on omega, you had some, they are included one into the other, but they mention you also have other types of critical points. I mean, they didn't say critical points, but they have other types of vortices that they call S that seem, that are joining one point to the other like this. So maybe I can remove this. I don't know if you still see it. It's in there. And so, of course, the aim was to understand in this line energy here that we have described, can we see S vortices and can we go a little further in the analysis? I don't know how much time I still have. 10 minutes, okay. So that was the next goal, which was to understand more than the minimizer. So we had understood that the minimizer had to be U vortices and not straight vortices. So then we wanted to understand what this S were. So maybe I can show you a numerical experiment first, is that when you do the numerics, you see that there are only three kinds of critical lines gamma. You have the U here, you have the S, but what is the S, as a matter of fact, is nearly a U where you have rotated this last part here by 180 degrees. And you have this, what we call three-dimensional S, that is where the parts down here has been rotated by 90 degrees. So this is in the XZ plane, and this one is in the YZ plane. And, of course, if your cross-section is a disk, then your S, the top and the bottom, can be in any plane. But as soon as the cross-section is not a disk, then You can see that as soon as you have a critical point of this line energy, you have a non-zero gradient as soon as your upper part or bottom part of the S is not in either the XZ plane or the YZ plane. So that's why in some sense you can have only these kind of three shapes. So this is that the numerics. Now, let me tell you what we have proved. And also maybe I should show you that when you increase omega, the S, the extension of the S in the Z direction is also increasing. So when omega is large, the straight part is very long, and when omega gets smaller, then the straight part gets smaller. So what we could prove is the following. So if omega is too small, then there is no critical point of the energy which stays in the half plane Y positive. This means that, in fact, there is no U. That is, if omega is too small, you can provide, if you assume that you have, so if I sit in the YZ plane here, and if I imagine that I have a U at the critical point, then if omega is sufficiently small, I can prove that I can do a small perturbation of this U here that is going to provide a non-zero gradient of the line energy. But on the other hand, whatever omega, you can find that there is an S, which is a critical point of the energy. That is, if you minimize this line energy in the set where this characteristic function chi is such a way that the curve gamma will be odd, so will be an S, with gamma is symmetric with respect to zero, then you can find a local minimizer whatever the value of omega. And indeed, numerically, you can see that the S is going down to zero, which is different from the U. No, the chi has to be different because, okay, I have to remind you the definition of the chi. The chi is going to be, all right, I can put it here. If I have a curve like this, the chi is going to be 1 here and 0 here. If I have a curve like this, the chi is going to be 1 here and 0 here. Okay, so there is a curve, an S curve for any value of omega, and there's an extra minimization that which is of interest, is to minimize the first part of the energy, which is this one that I call H, while fixing the value of L here. So if you do this, then I'll show you what is going on. Maybe I'll show it to you on the curve here. So this I've shown. So let me just come back to that for a while. If here we have plotted the energy of the solution. So you see that the U vortex is here. And actually, the U vortex exists down to a value of omega such that its energy is positive. So that when I define the critical energy for which a U starts to be a minimizer, this critical energy would be around here. But actually, the U goes down existing slightly below here, but it doesn't exist for lower value of omega. And this is something that should be related to the fact that if I now I plot for these solutions, I plot the H, which is the first part of the energy, against the L, for the values of these minimizers, actually the curve is convex. And this is, now I need another slide. This is right. So actually, you can prove that the curve, for the global minimizer, the curve has to be convex. And it was a conjecture of Bob that actually for small L, at that level here, when the U stops existing, what should going on is that the curve should change concavity. It should get concave. And this was also related to some kind of minimization problem that Bob McCann had studied, I believe you mentioned. But this is something we couldn't see exactly, and we couldn't prove. So, oh, maybe I should prove. So what Bob has proved rigorously is, so if you start with a local minimizer of E gamma, then he can prove that there's a local minimizer of E epsilon, which vorticity is close to the gamma naught. And when the minimizer is trivial, then the global minimizer is asymptotically vortex-free. And also, he could identify the fact that mathematically there is this critical value down to which the U exists is lower than the critical value for which the energy gets negative. But still, okay, so still this is something to be understood is that when you minimize this H with the value of L which is small, then there is a minimizer, and this should provide a critical point of the energy for a value of omega, which is a new critical point, which is a U, but which is a U which is not the global minimizer. It should be just a saddle point. So this is something that is still not totally understood, but should be related to the recent physics experiment. So let me say a few words still. In the last minute, as I said at the beginning, there are a lot of experiments going on at the moment on those Einstein condensates, and I would say there are a lot of very interesting problems. So one of them, which is related to experiments going on at the ENS at the moment, is the idea is to change the trapping. That is, usually everybody for the moment is using a harmonic trap, and the idea would be to change the trap, which is experimentally very difficult. And one first approximation would be to have a trap which is quartic at far away, and so where you kill the first harmonic contribution here. And the issue for doing this kind of trapping is that the function rho is not going to be just concave like that. It's going to be zero inside. Maybe I should have drawn it like that. So if I imagine it, that is, before I had something that was like this, and now the new function rho is going to be zero in the center. So the idea is to find the existence of giant vortices. So they have started to observe them a few months ago at the ENS, and this is a joint work which is going on with Stan Alama and Nia Bronsart. And the issue is that now the critical omega for the existence of a vortex is no longer of order log epsilon as before, but is of order 1, and you find a giant vortex. But if you go at order log epsilon, then you expect to have a giant vortex inside and to have isolated vortices on a radius that you can identify with respect to, oh, I call this, oh, it should be rho here, with some integral of rho. And if you go to the numerical simulation, there, I just brought one of them, which is something which is still under work, is that you can reach situation where you have a giant vortex that's for some z and isolated vortices in the middle. So there are a lot of open problems related to this very recent experiment. Maybe in the last word, I was hoping to have some more time to explain you what we did related. So one of the first experiments related to Bose-Einstein condensate was to have a condensate to look at it in the other way like this and to stir a laser inside, so which is the equivalent of the experiment of flowing a superfluid along an obstacle. And the particularity here is that, of course, in this direction you have a z dependence of the trap, and because of that, when you do this experiment, you're going from a situation where you have nonlinear Schrodinger equation in this region to a linear equation in that region because of the inhomogeneity due to the trapping. So I just show you very recent numerical experiment, and where we just provided a new model to explain the existence of drag. So what is going on is that when you have a very small velocity of your obstacle here, you don't have any vortices. And when you start nucleated, the vortices, they nucleate from the bottom, they go up the obstacle, and then they detach and move away in the stream. And what we could observe is that as soon as you have vortices, you have a big drag, but you also have drag, whatever the value of the velocity, you also have drag at low velocity, which was something new. And this drag is due to the existence of a field at far distance, and especially it is not always due to the existence of vortices, but due to the fact that you have a linear equation down. So I would say my conclusion would be that the presence of this trapping here is really providing a lot of new patterns, in the sense that you have the shape of vortices that is going to be different, and I think that there is still a lot of analysis and mathematical analysis, interesting mathematical analysis to be done. I thank you for your attention.